Post and Gannett came in as bidders. And we got the man more money than he ever dreamed he would see. And it all happened because I could go to an investment banking firm and say, I got a client who's cash poor, but he's got this asset. We can work it so that we can sell the shop, the stock. We'll get paid. If we can't, there's not much money there because this guy's just barely eking out a living. And the investment banker said, well, we do a lot of work together. We'll take a chance. And we accomplished it. And we had a dinner in New York for this man and his family. And it was fascinating just to listen to it because he had a very talented daughter who had an important position in Washington with one of the accounting firms. Her husband was a medical researcher at the NIH. And of all people, he's the one who spoke up at the dinner and said, you know, I want you to understand what this means. We were about at the point where I was prepared to resign from the NIH and go out to make money because we've got children and I have to go to college. Now, I don't have to leave NIH. I can do my research work at NIH and there'll be enough money for all of us to live our lives. Well, you don't think about those things every day, but seeing a family this way gives you a nice sense of comfort that you've done something constructive. I had a call a couple of months ago from a doctor in this town who said, I'm in trouble, I need your help. I go, come on down, I'll buy you lunch and tell me. Well, he's a specialist. And most of his patients are DuPont employees or DuPont pensioners. DuPont changed its health care coverage to a different company. That company came into town and selected a group of physicians as its authorized physicians. And he didn't hear about it until late in the game. And when he heard about it, he went to them and asked to be put on the list as an authorized physician. And said, no, it's too late. And so he took the appeal to Philadelphia and what have you. Turned out all of it. So he came in, I want to sue them. They're going to put me out of business. And it's a real dilemma. It happens to a lot of doctors, and it's a real dilemma. And I said, well, the first thing I've got to do is check to see whether our firm has represented that insurance company. Because if they have, I'm disqualified from representing it. And I checked. And sure enough, we've done a lot of work for that insurance company. But instead of signing off, what I did is call the partner of the firm who represented the company and said, yeah, here's the dilemma. I said, why can't you talk to somebody you know in that company and get them to be sensible? Putting this one doctor on the list isn't going to make any difference to them, and it makes an enormous difference to the man. So he said, let me talk to the people at the client, and I'll call him back. And he called back, and he said, I want you to have your client call so-and-so, who's chief of healthcare operations in the legal department. And he doesn't want any lawyers involved, so don't you get on the phone, don't have anybody on the phone except your client. So I went out and sat down with my client and said, doctor, now do what I tell you this time. Don't get off the reservation. Don't call this afternoon. Call first thing in the morning when they're fresh. And tell your story and see what happens. Well, the answer was they put them on hold for 10 days and then called up and said, you're in. And if we had sued, we'd still be litigating. I didn't make a nickel out of that, and I didn't want to. But here was a fine doctor, who was my own doctor, as a matter of fact, and who would have been really destroyed financially if we hadn't solved the problem. I got a tremendous charge out of doing something like that. All was involved was a phone call. But having the ability to call the right person, get something to happen, is the whole ballgame. So, now, you try to get all the business you can, do all those things, but down deep you know that that's not really what you're after. You're after the ability to use your skills in a constructive way. A few months ago, the governor called up and said, I got to have you mute. Why? Well, GM has announced they're going to shut down the plant here. And that's 3,600 people out of jobs. A lot of suppliers out of business as well. And we've got to get organized to take steps to have the state respond as best we can. Well, I said, all right, I'll take it on. And we'll do the study and get the facts on one condition. And that is that you don't demonize General Motors. Don't start on the premise that they're evil and we're going to correct evil. Instead, start on the premise that they're fine businessmen. We've had them in Delaware for a lot of years. And economic circumstances may be forcing their hand, but we want to work with them. Well, to make that story short, they did a number of things, including organizing the small business manufacturers in the state. And they found 200 truly exciting businessmen that I had never heard of. But the people that started up businesses and grew them. Had one fellow who started working with DuPont, had his own business, and he was doing business all over the world, and 200 employees. Long story short, we got the state organized to improve its practices with respect to manufacturing in the state. And secondly, we maintained our relationships with General Motors in such a way that when the automotive market turned up, they came back and said, hey, we're not going to close the plant, 96, as we'd said. You can't put that on the books anyplace, but the fact is that by doing it the right way, we accomplish something. Get satisfaction out of that. It's a lot better than hitting a bad drive on a golf course.
You still golf?
I quit this year. It got worse and worse as we got older. And then my wife and I looked at each other one day and said, why are we torturing ourselves? We're not having fun anymore. And so we thought, all right, let's call it quits. No point in making your body do something it can't do well. And as a matter of fact, I just got a check from my club this week getting a refund on my membership.
Well, I know we've taken up quite a bit of your time this morning. I have just a couple more questions if you have time.
You've got me until you're out of gas.
Okay. In 1985, you wrote a book with someone, I think, from DuPont. From DuPont. America's Third Revolution.
Yeah.
Why at that point did you decide to write that book?
Well, I let myself get talked into it. I had made a series of speeches on various public policy issues and business. And people came around and said, you know, you really ought to convert those speeches into a book. And then Harper came in and said, we'd like to publish it. And that was too tempting to walk away from. I'm not sure if I had my life to live over again, I would have written the book. It was very successful on college campuses. The rest of the world didn't give a damn about it at all. But I can go up to the Kennedy School, and I'm a big name there because they got the book. But you don't realize what you're really getting into when you write one of these things if you can do it well. And it was a major undertaking. And I wouldn't regard it as a financial success, although I had no financial stake. Since it involved the speeches I'd done at DuPont, the royalties were set to go to DuPont.
And, of course, then we come to Howard Hughes Institute, which...
Well, that's a different world entirely. And I might add, It's the second time in my life where, as a non-scientist, I'm running an operation that depends on scientists. Howard Hughes, it's a long story, you know. When Hughes died, there were three of his retainers who sort of saw themselves as the executive committee at the Howard Hughes Institute. And there was Hughes' nephew who didn't buy that at all, so he brought a lawsuit against these people, challenging their authority to run the Institute. And in the meantime, these three guys decided they'd better bring some fresh blood in if they're going to have any respectability. And so they got my name, a retired dean of the Harvard Business School, and propositioned me. And I said I was interested, but not while they were in litigation. If they got that resolved, I'd consider doing it. And after a trial, the judge ruled that these guys were not authorized. And since there was no one authorized, the court would appoint a board. And he appointed eight trustees, left one vacancy to be filled by the eight. And each side submitted names for consideration. And lo and behold, my name survived. And so I got involved with this thing as a trustee. And was appalled at what I found. They were running a decent science program, but their business affairs were simply chaotic. They were engaged in a long-term fight with the IRS dating to 1969. Penalties were accruing some huge sum per day. And I took one look at that and said, well, first thing we're going to do is make peace with the IRS. We can't live with these kind of penalties because ultimately we'll be out of business if we continue this. And so we recruited a first-rate staff of tax experts, then went to the IRS and said, it's a whole new ballgame. People you've been fighting with are gone. They're really not gone. They're part of the trustees, but they're surrounded by new trustees. And it's a whole different ballgame. And over a period of a year, year and a half, we proved that to them. And we worked out a settlement that was quite satisfactory. And so we solved our IRS problem. And then, well, at the same time, I recognized that here was a medical research operation of quite some significance that was dependent on dividends from a single company. And if that company ever had a bad year, their research program was in difficulty. And so we made the same decision that the Ford Foundation made, and they took the Ford shares public, and we said we're going to sell the Howard Hughes airplane company and use the proceeds to finance medical research. Well, sometimes you have to have divine guidance, and we happen to pick a period when that industry was at its peak in the market. And we ran an auction and got over $5 billion for the company from General Motors. And there are two other bidders, Boeing and Ford, close to them. And suddenly, we had independence. We could have a diversified portfolio. That $5 billion is now close to $8 billion. And we're putting out about $350 million a year in medical financing. But most of it is medical research, but about $50 million is grants to various institutions to encourage the study of science. Some museums even, but we found, for example, a black school in New Orleans in which 90% of its graduates go on to graduate work, and most of them in medicine. And so you go down and say, what's going on here? And they tell you their story, and it's a simply marvelous story. And you say, could you find a use for $2 million more a year? And they kiss your feet. And what you find is that they've gone out and recruited among the black community in the South the talented kids they could find, got them to the school, made them into something, educated them, and turned them on so that they want to do something with their lives. And they're all going to medical school. So we're putting up about $50 million for things like that, museums and scholarship money for some students in medical school, and a number of programs of that sort. So it's about $50 million is a foundation, in a foundation mode, and about $300 million in running medical research laboratories. This has turned out to be an exhilarating experience. Again, I sit at science meetings. I can't understand very often what's being said. Once turned to the man behind me, he said, you know, I don't have any science in my background. I didn't understand that. And he said, Herb, I'm a physician, and I didn't understand it either. And the answer, of course, is that it's such new stuff, such new language, that unless you're in your 20s or early 30s, you're lost. But it's a thrilling experience to see these bright young people come in, take on research assignments, and then report on them. And almost every week, you're getting another discovery, another gene defective that causes this or that. The most recent one was the one at Rockefeller, where he found the gene that relates to fat. Well, that was a huge scientist. And next week it'll be something else. I'm living in a sort of a dream world when I sit down at meetings. There are a couple of Nobel laureates at the same table, and the very brightest of the medical people in the country and Canada are serving on our committees, and we're trying to use money in a very constructive way, and it's being recognized in the scientific circles that Hughes is making quite a difference in the world. And just to show you how things go, we discovered that the scientists in Eastern Europe are starving. They can't get funding. Some are getting jobs as cab drivers or anything, just to live. And we discovered that for $10,000, you could hire a top-drawer scientist with his staff, and they would take care of his expenses in his laboratory, too. And so we run a contest, really, in which we've selected a group of scientists and all through Eastern Europe, and are naming them Hughes scientists, and they'll get money grants to keep them in business. Now, I don't know who's going to make the next great discovery, but it could very well be one of those people. And the thought of it, that for $10,000 a laboratory went down, makes you worry about things. So we're trying, and we're having great success, and that takes a fair amount of my time now, but I guess I average about a day a week, but it's a real challenge, and the thing that turns me on is, apart from the goals, is using the skills I developed. I don't have to make medical decisions, but I knew how to recognize problems with the IRS and problems with management of the place, and how to get that straightened out and how to manage it properly. And so it's an interesting activity that I wouldn't have counted on, but there it is.
mentioned management, you once wrote an article in which you said that management cannot be reduced to a science.
That's right. You're dealing with judgment. You can't reduce your life to any mathematical formula. And our judgment calls all the time make the difference. Management knows it's going to make mistakes. Very often they're mistakes because you never have all the facts when you need them. But you've got to make a decision. And the judgment calls are kind of the guts of any successful enterprise. My definition of success is being right 51% of the time. There's nobody who's smart enough to call all these shots and call them all right. But good management will be more successful, and it will face up to the fact that it has made mistakes when it makes a mistake. And that's the difference between successful companies and less successful companies. Quality of judgment.
Isn't that what the chemical industry did originally? After Rachel Carson and Silent Spring, they stonewalled for a while before they realized that they had to be more honest about what was happening.
Yeah, that's right. And then that was one of the jobs that Dick Heckert got from us. We sent him down to Congress to teach him about cancer. I can't remember the issue now, but there was some claim that cancer was all over the place. And Dick went down there and called on everybody and gave them a little lesson on what is cancer and what is not cancer, and changed perceptions on what the problem was. But I can't remember whether it was the LR thing on apples or whether it was something like that, but it was one of those affairs where there was no real problem, but an issue had been built up to the point where people were scared. When you said cancer, people thought of death, and they would do anything. And it was Dick's job to go down and talk turkey with him in terms of what cancer is and what it isn't. Given his big figure and his manner, he was very effective talking the straight way he does, and persuaded a lot of people that they're simply misinformed. There's been a lack of wisdom in the industry from time to time, no question about it. And in the earlier days particularly, it was often based on political considerations, and anybody who knew would recognize that writing a check is no guarantee of anything, and yet they naively thought it was.
Well, I've sort of come to the end of my question list. Do you have anything else that
You got tired, huh?
Well,
I'll make you a proposition. We're serving a luncheon today downstairs for our lawyers. If you were interested, the three of us could slip down there and grab a platter, sit off in a corner by ourselves and not interfere with them, and you'd get a good meal.
All right, we'll take you up on that.
Let's go. Let's go before they shut it down.
Thank you for spending time with us this morning.
Oh, I appreciate it.
Thank you.